This episode of Datanauts is brought to you by IT Pro TV. IT Pro TV is an easy, entertaining approach to online IT training. For a free 7-day trial and 30% off the life of your account, go to itpro.tv/datanauts and use the code DATANAUTS30. Datanauts are silo-busting IT provocateurs going outside the accepted norm of IT behaviors, crossing the aisle to have conversations with developers and fellow infrastructure engineers. Why? Well, it's all in the name of designing the best application delivery system possible. There's no way to do that without everyone getting around the whiteboard and hashing it out. I am Ethan Banks, at EC Banks on Twitter. My co-host is back from pitching his latest idea for a frozen pizza in the shape of a house, and he's Chris Wall. And you can find him at Chris Wall. Joining the Datanauts today to discuss the problems of IT culture is Bridget Krumhout. Bridget, thanks for finding the time in your impossible schedule to join us today. And would you please introduce yourself to the nice people listening?
Hi. Thanks for having me, Chris and Ethan. This is great. Bridget Krumhout. I do tech advocacy for Cloud Foundry at Pivotal. I've probably described my role at Pivotal before as pink-haired thought leadership as a service. I'm about that level of seriousness, fair warning. I think you folks wanted to talk about one of the provocatively titled, semi-controversial talks that I've been doing these days.
Yeah, that talk caught my eye. It was Containers Won't Fix Your Broken Culture.
Yeah, there's a subtitle, too.
Oh, what was the subtitle?
Containers Won't Fix Your Broken Culture and Other Hard Truths.
Well, and of course, since silo busting is one of the things we do on Datanauts, I'm like, okay, you know, so Bridget here is talking about part of the challenges of IT operations versus developers and DevOps and, you know, is in the middle of that world. So, okay, let's have her on and have this chat. As we were prepping for this show, Bridget, we kind of broke this up into three chunks here, containers and then microservices and then platforms and then the human aspect of these technical things and how they impact our humanity as we do this stuff. If we start off in the context of containers, there's a divide between dev and ops. It doesn't exactly equal a hands-off deliverable where we can just say, oh, containers mean devs can do what they want because they can just package up their stuff into a container form factor. I'm waving and manipulating my hands and arms over my head right now. And throw your stuff in the container and it's all fine and we don't really have to think. There's more to the story than that, isn't there?
There certainly is, yeah. A little bit of backstory for your listeners who maybe haven't paid quite as much attention to my recent work history as I have. I know there might be some. My last job before Pivotal, I went to go work at a little streaming video company that you probably haven't heard of. It's much like Netflix, if Netflix were much smaller and mostly Korean soap opera, and ran Docker in production since October 2013. Drama Fever started running Docker in production when I think the main thing on Docker's website was like, under no circumstances should you run this in production. And we were like, YOLO. So one of the really interesting things about doing containers in production before a lot of people were is that while I think the container story that gets told is this happy path dev story of a dev can build a container on their local laptop and that can go right out to production and it'll be exactly what they built. I mean, reality is always messier than that, right? We actually were using containers in production more specifically for operational needs around our deployments before the devs were even really starting to use them, which is kind of backwards, I think, from how the narrative often goes. And so like it was really useful when we started moving from just having a bunch of Python code to also having some Go microservices. It started being really useful to not just have to check out some Python code, bake an AMI, and start using that in Amazon, but actually be able to have a deliverable that was like a version deployable artifact that was this container is what we've put either the Go binary or the Python code in. For example, like if ops is deploying like that, then dev can pull down the exact container that's running in production to troubleshoot against. So like there are places where even though dev and ops groups might be, you know, not talking to each other as much as they should be, the containers do help with that. I think the problem comes in, though, when people think that if you have containers, they're going to act as this magical panacea that makes it unnecessary for your groups to communicate with each other at all. Because, like, I can tell you from personal experience, that did not work.
I mean, this, the kind of the promise there, as I understand it, with containers, it abstracts away the operating systems. There's a lot of dependencies and concerns you don't have to worry about anymore. Package up that code and that app, put it into the container form factor, and it's going to fit in that hole that's waiting for the container to occupy it, and it should just work. But in fact, not always.
Well, so let's go into the technical realities here. It should just work if everything is on expected ports. It should just work if you're in your data center or your IaaS or whatever, you've set up the correct firewalls or security groups. It should just work if the container is talking to a backing service, say a data store or some kind of session layer that expects it to be talking to it, and the schemas are right. I mean, you start to see how the stuff inside the container is part of the story, but it's not the entire story, right?
Well, just ports. I mean, just that. Right? Depending on what the scenario is, ports can be whatever that's been assigned to them. Not most of the scenarios I've seen, they're not expected ports. They're something random because they're sitting behind a proxy server. They need to be randomized in order to function and scale.
Sure. Just because you have some dev developed some code that tested out great locally, maybe made it through your CI/CD pipeline just fine. You know as well as I do that if you're writing your Jenkins jobs or Concourse or GoCD, whatever it is you're using, you write a certain amount of mocks. I mean, you're going to probably like also spin up a MySQL container full of stuff that looks sort of like your database so that you can check a few things when you're running your tests. Like you're probably, say you're using RDS and AWS, Jenkins is probably not going out to your production RDS and testing things. So it's like, you can always say, well, this is tested end to end. Is it? I mean, did you test the exact thing that's in prod? Like by definition, you didn't, right?
By definition, you didn't. Exactly.
So why the focus on containers specifically as something that's not going to fix your culture? Because I feel like you could insert any technology into that sentence and it's not going to fix culture. Is it just containers are hot and sexy and everyone wants to think that they're going to fix it magically?
I'm laughing because I don't know if you follow Alice Goldfuss on Twitter. She's hysterical. But she tweeted something saying, when people call technology sexy, I imagine them humping a monitor.
That's a good thing this is audio only.
But yeah, so containers are one that people think will prevent the teams that classically have that wall of confusion, have that possibly opposing interests, possibly diametrically opposed incentives. Containers often are viewed as a panacea to prevent clashes between ops teams and dev teams, when honestly, that couldn't be further from the truth, because you still have to build infrastructure that the containers will run on. Whether you're choosing something like ECS or GKE or any of the other IaaS-provided container platforms, or something much more complex, like you still have to make a lot of choices that are outside the purveyance of the specific container. And so while the popular narrative in the last couple of years has been containers solve all these problems, I feel like we need a little dose of reality that no, not so much. Like I like right. Containers. I wouldn't want to go back to not using them, but they're not going to magically make your groups like each other.
Because you bring up the network and in the past example, or at least some networking examples, and those aren't just completely eliminated, right? You still need to build out the entire platform, the infrastructure. But containers do solve a number of issues, though, right? It does kind of package the code into a more consumable artifact. I remember the days of the dev team would throw me the install sheet, like the deploy sheet, because ops had to do that. That was always something you did over the weekend. It never worked right, and Monday was just spent fixing it in prod because it was still busted. That, to me, is kind of what we're solving with containers.
Well, and again, containers don't fix the fact that you still have to have some communication with each other about what the container expects around it. Just because, say, the container has expectations, again, about things like firewall rules. Like you can have a perfectly good container with perfectly good code in it, but if it can't get to the database, your app is still going to be down in prod. So
it's always a networking issue, even with containers. Congrats, Ethan. It's always your problem, man.
Exactly. Well, how much of that is set off with something like Docker Compose?
It really depends on whether or not, again, like Docker Compose is going to stand up whatever you've defined that you can do inside the purveyance of Docker. So if you have, for example, I'll go back to AWS examples. If you're using ElastiCache, for example, you're probably not standing those up in Docker Compose. So like at that point, you may have to wrap that with some Terraform or CloudFormation or whatever.
Can you go back to something you mentioned earlier, the wall of confusion? What I'm confused. What's the wall of confusion so we're all clear? Sure.
Absolutely. So my friend and current boss at Pivotal, Andrew Clay Schaefer, put this in a slide in 2009, I think it was. And it's just a picture of two stick figures on either sides of a brick wall with this imaginary, the devs on one side of the wall are just kind of tossing blocks of code over at the ops on the other side of the wall. And I look at that and I kind of think, I don't think of it so much as like they just tossed some code over the wall and now we have to figure out, like you said with the checklist, why it won't deploy correctly. But I also think of it as like, I've kind of joked on a slide with this before and talks about team YOLO and team nope, which is to say, if devs are incented to ship features, exciting new features as quickly as possible, and any bug reports can definitely go in the icebox because somebody can do some backlog grooming and care about those bugs someday, but features, 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 that's what our story points are all about, et cetera. Here, make our burn down charts look good, make our Gantt charts look good. If that's how the incentives are set up for your dev team, and they are sometimes, depending on exactly how religious people are about their Agile or Scrum methodology, then if your ops team is focused on things like, hey, we have a bunch of SLAs with our customers, or our MTTRs look terrible, we're not restoring service as quickly as we should after every outage, why do these deploys not work out the way they should, and we're on an 18-hour conference call, and then we have to try to roll it back, and that doesn't work. And so they kind of start to resent the people who seem to be lobbing all of these problems over the wall at them. And this is, again, like whether or not those problems are in a shipping container. I mean, they might hurt more if they're giant in a shipping container and get lobbed over the wall at you, right?
Again, if features are the emphasis and the devs are just lobbing those over the wall as quickly as possible, which is causing downtime and making the ops people look bad, then now you've created this conflict between these two groups of people. But how do you overcome that, Bridget? So in a lot of organizations I've worked for, the dev teams and the infrastructure teams, operations teams, these are very different groups of people. So in my time in ops, which was most of my career, me going to a developer to try to figure what was up was like a thing. It's like, I didn't even know who the developer was a lot of times. Some representative from that team said, we need to stand up infrastructure that's going to house this app and it's going to do X. And you get the bare minimum of, I need some RAM and I need this, or I need this network configuration or these firewall rules punched through with no context really.
And then you look at that and you go, they want what?
Yeah, you just kind of like, okay, fine, do it. Or you look at it and go, this, man, maybe this doesn't make sense. And if I wanted to talk to a developer, because there was such a difference in the hierarchy within the company, it was hard to do.
Mm-hmm. A lot of organizations, and this is kind of, we get to the like DevOps thing, which people are all, oh yeah, you want us to sing Kumbaya and hold hands. That's great, but we need to be effective. And I would say, like, if you look at the research coming out of, for example, the State of DevOps report, Nicole Forsgren has been doing a bunch of statistically valid peer-reviewed research that shows that organizations that break down some of those barriers, like you mentioned with busting silos, organizations that make it possible for somebody who's going to operate this stuff in production to have a conversation with the people who are designing it, maybe even before they write some code, so that they can maybe advise them and say, okay, see how you want to go back to the database N times? Like, you could do that, but let's just have a conversation about, say, hey, if you like that query, maybe put an index on it, you know?
Or things like latency. When you end up with microservices, you have the opportunity to spread your workloads all over the geographical place. And sometimes now you're running a query against something that's milliseconds away when it used to be sub-millisecond, microseconds within the data center. All of a sudden, you've got a user experience impact.
And that seems actually possible because a lot of this, I don't know, correct me if I'm wrong, a lot of this is still pretty greenfield, right? A lot of folks aren't doing this in prod yet. So you could have those conversations today rather than trying to fix it 10 years or 5 years down the road.
Oh man, just imagining fixing some of today's more hilarious choices 10 years from now is like, I kind of look ahead and go, when can I retire? I assume you gentlemen have decided you're definitely retiring before January 2038, right? I'm looking ahead to the end of epoch time, and I'm like, I'll definitely be retired by then.
But, I think we need one of those giant debt clocks, but it's technical debt instead, and it's just in the quadrillions of dollars.
Hey, I was working in the industry for Y2K. Everyone says, oh, that wasn't a big deal. I'm like, yeah, because we worked our asses off.
Yeah, it was a big deal at the time, though. I mean, that's how the movie Office Space came out, and it was legit.
Seriously. PC load letter.
I gotta say, the wall of confusion sounds like being at a very unfair paintball game where you're not given a paintball gun, but everyone else is. And it's like, stop shooting me with these paintballs. If they keep lobbing over these changes at you and you just show me on the server where they touched you kind of thing. So been there, done that. It sounds like containers won't necessarily solve that, which is cool, but it's something to still keep in mind. Ethan, what are you thinking?
Very similar things. You know, depending on the processes that you've got in your organization, I mean, that process of dev handing off stuff to ops can really cause a lot of resentment. And I too have been in that role where something that got handed to me by someone else, I didn't have a lot of control over it, I just had to do it, caused things to break later. It's like, really? Couldn't we have had a conversation about this ahead of time instead of chucking things over the wall? There shouldn't be a wall. There should be folks working together. Sponsoring today's Datanauts is IT Pro TV, a repository of training for certifications. Now, several of you have asked me directly whether they are the real deal or not, so here is my honest impression. When they came to us a few months back, I spent a couple of hours on their site browsing through the catalog, using the interface, and sampling the course offerings. And so the short story is this. If I was working on a cert these days, IT Pro TV would definitely be a resource I'd consider. There is a ton of material, over 1,000 hours of videos. They add more every week. You can consume the videos on any sort of device you want. The classes are diverse. There's network stuff like CCENT, CCNA, etc., but then also Red Hat and certified ethical hacker training. So it's a really good library. And then you can sanity check that you're ready to take the real exam because they have virtual labs and they have Transcender practice exams that are included. And to me, that is a really big deal because the real exams are expensive. So it's good stuff there, but if you don't like it for whatever reason, you can cancel with no hassle. So if you are interested in group pricing, by the way, and already have an account with some other training company, IT Pro TV will match your previous year's pricing as an enticement to switch. They really want your business and will work to keep it affordable for your group. Check out itpro.tv/datanauts to access the most popular IT certifications. Premium subscriptions are normally $57 a month or $570 per year. But we have a special offer. Try it free for 7 days when you sign up using our code DATANAUTS30. You'll also receive 30% off the lifetime of your account. That's less than $40 per month or $399 for the entire year. Visit itpro.tv/datanauts, use the code DATANAUTS30, and try it free for 7 days, plus save 30% off the life of your account.
All right, containers, we've got that. Check the box. It's done. Put a lid on it and a fork in it. Now I want to talk about microservices. And the first thing that we were talking about before we started recording the show was a slide that you had with some pizzas on there and a comment about two pizza teams. Bridget, what is a two pizza team? Describe what that is. And apparently it doesn't actually fix anything.
Well, okay. So this is more of the cargo culting the practices of a successful organization will not necessarily fix everything inside your organization. Amazon famously talks about having teams no larger than can be fed by two pizzas. And of course, being an ops person, I'm always going to worst case scenarios and corner cases. And so I'm thinking, like, how big are those pizzas and how hungry are those people? Like, that doesn't actually answer anything, right?
Yeah, when I was in my early 20s, I could polish off an entire pizza. So that's like a two-man team.
Right? Maybe you're an NX engineer where N is how many pizzas you can eat.
It sounds like an episode that we could pitch to the Silicon Valley TV show. Right? It sounds like something they would do, but please continue.
Right. So, all right. So, but the idea is sound, right? The idea is, instead of what we were talking about before, with there's an ops team that gets this spec sheet of some infrastructure they're supposed to stand up that seems internally inconsistent. It makes no sense. And they really kind of wish somebody talked to them 6 months ago because this is supposed to go live on Tuesday. Instead of that scenario, a two pizza team is considered to be a small cross-functional team that maybe has designer or two and some developers, maybe they're full stack, whatever that is, or some people who can do some front end and some people who can actually write database related queries and maybe some people who actually know how to operate the infrastructure and maybe a product person. And if all of those people are focused on that one feature, then in theory, it will be easier and faster to get it out the door. They'll have full end-to-end ownership. And there is an actual benefit there if you think about it. When you don't have to have as many meetings or as many, now we have to wait for that other group to weigh in, you can move faster. So like there is a huge benefit there. But as you can imagine, if you're the sort of paranoid cynical that I am, you look at this and you think, well, that's great. So we've taken an ops person and totally isolated them from the other ops people. How much contextual knowledge are they going to retain if they spend all their time thinking about feature X? So like some organizations don't break things up exactly that way. Etsy, for example, is famous for having very successful stuff in the DevOps realm. And I like to call Etsy a monitoring company that also sells tea cozies. Like they've open sourced a lot of great monitoring tools. They actually go with designated ops people to support different teams, but they specify that they're not dedicated, which is to say those ops people still understand all of the operational stuff. And Etsy, they're old school, man. They do data centers. So like these ops people still understand everything from, you know, the heat or cooling in the data center to the Pixie boot on up, but they also are designated to work with, say, the Hadoop team or whatever.
Okay, that sounds kind of like a data center version of the sales model. You have account reps that cover a region, and they have specialists that they can pull in that are sales engineers to kind of support them. But those sales engineers kind of float around, and they understand the greater product. It sounds kind of like that model, but for data centers. You're an engineer. You understand, you know, all the bits and parts and pieces, and you get to focus on parts of the solution stack or the product stack, rather, within the company.
Right.
It sounds like we're just kind of borrowing from a different piece of the business world and applying that to IT.
I think there's a lot of value there too, right? Like there's an awful lot of IT problems that if we look at psychology, they help us. It's like, oh, right. Humans enjoy feeling like they're being listened to. This is something that's very applicable to tech.
So map that then to microservices, Bridget. So if I'm on, you know, a two pizza team, does every microservice that an application might be getting broken up into have a team? Is it an application that's got a team like this and manages all of the microservices?
Yeah, so it's really going to depend. I know that's a terrible answer, but that's the answer to everything in tech, right? It's really going to depend on your organization's needs. If you're Uber, for example, Matt Rainey from Uber was on stage at a conference some months ago saying that they're not sure how many GitHub repos Uber has, but it's in the hundreds. And so like they obviously don't have hundreds of them. They've lost track of how many they have. Okay, so because of all the microservices, they obviously don't have like an entire team of 8 people or whatever on every single one of those hundreds of microservices. So like things are broken up into kind of functional areas. Even if you look at Netflix, Casey Rosenthal from Netflix manages the chaos team, and he manages a couple of other teams with fascinating names that they'll come to me perhaps. I think, Intuition is another one, which is a fascinating idea for a team and something else. So it's like even with Netflix's chaos engineering, where they're injecting failure into the microservices to see how they behave, and then using features that they've developed in open source, like the Eureka for Service Discovery or Hystrix for circuit breaking, which is super valuable. If you have a distributed system, which a collection of microservices is, then if one piece fails, you don't want that to take everything else down. So you need some way to say, this part is broken, let's route around it and do whatever it is we can without having that. Like, for example, say your personalized recommendations don't work. That's cool, but you still want to be able to watch Netflix.
With microservices, though, I mean, part of the big idea here is if I have broken my application down into all of its component parts, then I am reducing my failure domain. I am adjusting my dependency tree in such a way that I can scale wherever it's needed without having to deal with the monolithic app. So there's two things here. You know, one is I've got this structure that's changed, and the way my infrastructure is impacted here, it's different than maybe the way I would have delivered that app before. And then there's a human aspect to it with, rather than one big app that I need to understand, I've got all these little pieces and parts and maybe different people with their specialties that I need to talk to. In reality, what are the challenges here? Because it sounds like I had an app, a monolithic app that I loved and nourished and knew all the people that were responsible for it. Now I've got, you know, in a sense, a bazillion little apps that could be spread all over the place and stood up in different ways. Did things just get better, or did things just get more confusing?
I have a really great tweet that somebody tweeted that I ended up putting on a slide that says something along the lines of, you know, microservices, because it's great to have every outage be like a murder mystery. And it's like, basically, you get trade-offs. Everything is trade-offs. So if you have the giant monolithic app, then that one person in that one department says, oh, you can't deploy because of whatever. And you can't get a change you need for something completely unrelated out there to fix a customer problem. So like it is super valuable. And this is one reason why, again, like a lot of Pivotal's customers and in my own experience, people push towards microservices because one of the big motivators is they want independent deployability. So if you have the flexibility to be able to deploy, you know, the bookmarking service or the image resizer, or, you know, in the case of like some of our insurance customers, like they might want to deploy the customer like reporting of an accident app, and they might want to deploy that a lot faster than, say, the claims adjustment stuff. And so like if that's all in one application, it becomes a lot harder to have the independence to respond to business needs or your organization's needs. So like there is a big benefit to having your system be broken down into both units of deployability and also of like what humans can hold in their mind. This is actually kind of interesting because Astrid Atkinson from Google, who's a director of search, was talking last year at QCon in San Francisco about decomposing Google's search monolith. So like they have a monolith, or at least last fall, they were in the process of starting to decompose a giant monolithic application that runs Google search. As you can imagine, they don't want to take that down for maintenance, but it's also gotten so giant that it's really hard for even a couple of people to hold the entire architecture in their minds. And so like when you want stuff to be at a human scale, you can actually reason about and make reasonable decisions about, if you can get ahead of that and keep your scope small for, you know, a service, then you don't run into the problem of, wow, this is now super huge and we have to start breaking it up, but breaking it up is going to be a significant effort. There's a huge benefit to keeping things to a scope you can reason about.
And that sounds really hard to, I don't know, to try to figure out ahead of time. I feel like it's almost, yep, you have to get to that size where it's like, whoa, this is too big. We got to chunk it up. Because when you first, I'm sure the team, when they first started writing search, weren't thinking that it was going to be a bajillion lines of code and require, right, thousands of people to run. So it's chicken and the egg kind of to me, this microservices. When do we do it? When do we not? I don't know.
Well, I mean, I think one of the differences, and people who look at microservices and they think like, oh, is this just SOA again? I think one of the differences is we're focused very mindfully today on where are the pain points of the stuff being tightly coupled. So whether it's independent deployability or the ability to reason about it, or back to the human component, different interest groups making decisions about it. So if you need to consult with these people over there on that other team before you can do anything to this piece, but not for this piece over here, wow, those logically should definitely be separate. That's where it actually gets into the human element also is like, as you can imagine, since a collection of microservices, it is a distributed system, you need to have clean APIs and versioning between the pieces.
Yeah, I was just going to say, if you've got a good API for the microservice, why do I need to talk to another human? Just look at the API documentation and we're done here.
In theory.
Yeah.
So what Amazon has actually run into, because, and this is one of those, you know, off the record, I've talked to a former Amazonian sort of thing, because they famously have everything communicate via APIs. Oh, but sometimes there's a breaking change in the API endpoints and the groups don't actually say anything to other people. Or sometimes like there's a breaking change in a point release.
Yeah,
or
they
just completely
deprecate
something. And it's like, Semver, what?
Yeah, I was actually reading a thread elsewhere about that where the API isn't versioned all that clearly beyond a major release. You know, typically it's a V1 or something in the URL, but not a V1 dot whatever. And can be challenging to make sure that, A, the person writing the API is making sure everything's backwards compatible and making sure that everything still works,
right,
as you make changes to it. And B, making sure that you're recognizing when that actually changes and uplifting the version of the API that you're talking to. So that could definitely be a challenge.
And there's another place that you can run into trouble. Like, for example, where I was at Drama Fever. Drama Fever actually has native apps, not just for streaming video on the web, but also for Android, iOS, Samsung Smart TV, Xbox, PlayStation, Roku, and probably other things that I can't remember. And so if you're trying to write that many native apps, obviously you have to have like backend APIs that support all those. But as you grow and change and realize that the super overloaded like V whatever that you were using is terrible and you want everybody to be on, you know, V4 or V5, okay, great. Go back into, you know, Grafana, build a bunch of queries so that you can see what's using the old versions. Oh, here's some stuff that you didn't even expect using like super old calls that you really want to deprecate. And then you have to go talk to that group, you know, hey, Xbox people, what are you doing over here that we didn't expect? Like you can't magically fix that just by, I guess you could deprecate it and see who screams, but...
This is funny. There was a recent announcement by VMware with their cross-cloud product that they are effectively, they're abstracting various public clouds using public APIs. And my brain immediately said, wow, they don't have any exclusive partnership or relationship. What happens when those API changes? What happens to those products underneath? Because there's not even an implied relationship there. They're just consuming public APIs.
Well, and so there's that. Like, if you're – and everybody who's ever built anything on the OpenGraph API, a couple of jobs ago, I did ops at a social commerce startup that was using Facebook's APIs. And one thing Facebook changed was – at one point, it was possible to consume the likes of people's friends. So if a person authed one of these apps, then we could harvest their likes and also their friends' likes and then run them through a whole bunch of MapReduce jobs and stick them in HBase. And it was fun. I mean, you know, quote unquote fun from the engineering side of things, at least. Who knows about the actual privacy implications, right? But at the time, it was really not easy or clear how, as a user of Facebook, you could turn off your friend's ability to share your data to apps that they were using. Did Facebook make that difficult to find on purpose? Who knows? But it wasn't even in the privacy permissions. It was like in the app's permissions. If you weren't even using any apps, you never would go in there. And then Facebook went and changed that. And they gave some warning, but like people who were depending on that for some kind of contract they had with a customer, it's like, oh, good luck.
So Bridget, related to all this, Conway's Law, break that down for us.
Okay, so it's interesting because Mel Conway is an interesting thinker who was talking about this stuff in the 60s. This is like 1967, 1968. He wrote a paper called How Committees Invent. I guess it was a lot of exciting stuff going on in the 60s. So maybe people didn't pay as much attention as they should have to a paper called How Committees Invent. But it's been phrased a bunch of different ways. I like Mel Conway's version that he kind of rephrased to say, like, any organization that designs a system will produce a design whose structure is a copy of the organization's communication structure. People have made a lot of hay over various aspects of this. The part that I'm really interested in is the word communication in there, because if you're saying that if you make software, it's going to look exactly like your org chart, that's kind of defeatist. I mean, it's kind of like, it's possible that it will come out to be true in a way. This is kind of the, like, if you have four teams working on the compiler, you're going to have a four-pass compiler sort of thing. But because people want ownership, people want their thing.
It maps to the human structure and you can write assign ownership and so on, but it doesn't necessarily mean it's an intelligently designed application.
Right. But this is, for example, you can see Conway's Law at work in the AWS CLI, because there's a whole bunch of places where what you need is describe, and other places you need show, and other places you need view, and like there's no consistency. And you're like, these groups don't talk to each other or compare notes in any way. If you're trying to make software, it's super important to look at how you structure your organization, but it's also important to look at how your organization communicates internally. If you're communicating internally by throwing tickets at each other that you may or may not ever answer in a timely fashion, you're probably going to end up with parts of your software that don't work super well with other parts. And like we've all used software like that.
Right? There's another way.
Well, and so this is where, again, it's possible that if an organization, for example, invites other teams to their sprint planning or standups or whatever, like if you try to be mindful about making sure that other people who are going to be stakeholders in the end result of whatever you're creating have a chance to see it while it's in progress, and it, in a formal or informal way, if you have decent communication between teams, it's a lot more likely that you're not going to run into as many of these problems.
You know, Chris, the big thing I picked up out of this, APIs are not an abstraction for humans. They're an abstraction for a lot of things, but not for human beings. And just because our team's got these microservices under our care and feeding, we wrote the APIs and we documented them, so we don't need to talk to those other people, is not necessarily true. You've got error situations, you've got issues with the service itself that you need to alert people using the service that they're, oh, we're actually having a rough day because of, you know, whatever's going on. And you can't just say, I've got an API, you know, leave me alone, because that's what you're talking to. Not an abstraction for humans. What about you?
We need to find a way to abstract humans and do a Kickstarter for that. I think we'd get funding pretty quick. But you know, the two pizza team thing caught me. I had not heard that before. And I guess non-snarkily, that sounds like turning people into microservices. You know, it's essentially turning people into little bits of functionality and little bits of focus. And I kind of get that. The complexity is a real challenge. And I remember really, really complex data centers where there was one or two people that had been there forever and they kind of knew where all the skeletons were buried. And that's not really going to be the best way to move forward. So the idea of chunking things down into smaller units of work, both by complexity and by the count of people in a team, makes sense in some ways. And I gotta say, I'm also adding work for chaos team to my resume bucket list. So if anyone's hiring someone that needs someone to do basically nothing for free and pay me a lot of money to be on a chaos team, I'll come hang out with you.
Bridget, we've been talking about containers. We've been talking about microservices and how leveraging those tools introduce some challenge into human communications, the problems that we can solve with those tools, and then the problems that we don't solve with those tools. But it occurs to me that, in fact, as organizations and as businesses, we're not actually delivering containers and microservices to the world. We're delivering platforms, some kind of a service here, right? So how do we translate all this and, you know, move up the stack to the platform?
Those of us who are tasked with running IT infrastructure, I mean, in some ways it feels super unglamorous. It's like, great, we're the computer janitors. Like, people are only going to complain when it doesn't do what they want. But they're not going to say, hey, great job configuring servers this year. That's not a thing that usually we hear that we did a great job on. And I think when, especially if the dev teams are clamoring for, you know, let us use containers, or I was talking to somebody at an Agile gathering last year where they said, this year our VP says we need to have some microservices. Help? And I was like, what does your VP think these will solve for you? So like that does happen. But I think usually we're being asked to, in IT, we're being asked to be enablers. Like, we're being asked to enable whatever value, whatever goals the organization has that they're trying to deliver, whether it's services to end users, or like more coherent something for internal users. And like, so we're tasked with, how do we stand up something repeatable and debuggable, you know, something we can reason about that will still allow everyone to have all of the shiny things they want, because everyone wants something shiny, but it will actually work. And so that's where we kind of start thinking about how we compose our infrastructure as a whole.
And which is where these containers and microservices begin to make sense if you look at Google infrastructure for everyone else, or you're just at that scale already and kind of working that model. I think that's where these techniques come to bear. We are able to deliver, from an IT perspective, a specific value to the organization, how we can deliver an application as opposed to the way we used to do it, which was painful and difficult to make changes and so on. I'm still chuckling about the VP that was asking for microservices. How did that happen?
I'm going to assume it's kind of like the old Dilbert cartoon. I think we need a database. And Dilbert says, what color would you like that database? And the manager says, I think mauve has the most RAM.
Yes. Yeah,
and you're like, okay, I know where you're getting your information.
Isn't there a danger here, though, when we as either developers or infrastructure people, you know, want to do the next shiny things? You're mentioning shiny things. Isn't there a danger there that we're kind of going down that road because, ooh, this is shiny and everyone's talking about this on Twitter. I'm going to dig into this thing, whatever it is, and you'll pick up Kubernetes or whatever because it's shiny. You just go and do that.
And so this is kind of back to what we were talking about earlier with incentives. So if you're going to let the people who are going to be excited about putting everything from the front page of Hacker News on their resume, if you're going to let all of those people make all the decisions, what you are going to end up with is what I like to call resume-driven development. Because if you think about it, if your choices are do something super solid, probably boring, and make incremental value improvements, or I implemented the shiniest of shiny three different things that nobody thought could work together, I kludged them together, we got it out into prod, and now I have a new job, that ends up not necessarily being to the best interests of the organization. And yet it's super tempting for individual practitioners. I will totally raise my hand and say, I am the sort of person who's like, this is fun. This is exciting. I want to play with this.
As a guy who's lived in the networking silo for much of his career, I'll tell you what, there's so many nerd knobs you can twist that do different things. It's very tempting to build these science experiments. Only early in my career, I got into situations where the network I was handed was filled with science experiments that were impossible to maintain and make work. And so my job was not turning more nerd knobs. It was turning them off and simplifying the network so that you had an infrastructure you could actually support.
And if you think about it, especially with network stuff, you want that to be reproducible. And you also really, really don't want to have to drive to the data center in a panic because somebody didn't type right. This is something that completely happens, right?
So how do you balance that then? You don't want to just turn on a bunch of stuff you don't need. You want to play with new technology, but you got to make sure that it's delivering value to the organization. You know, who's kind of monitoring that and making sure that it's not just whiz-bang shiny stuff being pumped into the environment for the point of building up your resume for the future?
Honestly, I think that the people who are managing application development teams, managing IT infrastructure teams, not people in the C-suite necessarily, but people who just have that middle management job are the ones who are tasked with making sure that there's a good balance between their employees get good career development, but they're also serving the organization's best interests. This is where, again, like from higher up in the organization, from your, you know, your C-suite and VPs on down, if you set up incentives, if you align incentives such that everyone delivering this, you know, new, say, application or whatever it is you're trying to deliver for the organization, and the application running in production and being stable and producing some reasonably quantifiable amount of visible value. Like if you kind of set your incentives for the quarter or year or whatever like that, Then everybody knows that everyone's in that together. The people who might want to try the latest shiny, untested, totally beta thing might get other people disagreeing with them because they don't think that that's actually going to deliver for what the organization has actually established as being valuable.
So the high up people that have no real, I guess, leg to stand on when they're like, we need this specific technology. It's like, no, you're responsible for strategy and vision. Stop telling us the tactical stuff.
Well, and I think that's also dangerous, right? Like, if you, and I work for a vendor, but if somebody goes in and, you know, shakes hands or plays golf or whatever with somebody at the top level of an organization, and then they're like, we're going to buy something. Well, we have a lot of homework to do at that point where we have to have our platform architects come in and work with the people who are actually on the ground working, you know, getting stuff in the data center running and say, hey, you have a bunch of OpenStack right now. We're going to work with you to show you a proof of concept of this Cloud Foundry stuff that we have on your OpenStack. Oh, look, it actually works. Like there's a lot of homework that needs to be done there. That's not just somebody high up heard that Cloud Foundry is great, so you have to use it. Like that's not acceptable to most people in IT.
At the same time, you mentioned something a little earlier, which was you still want your people to have a career development path internally. So it's not like you just, you reject things either because they're new or beta necessarily. Yes, you need to match tools that are going to be useful to the organization for business reasons. And at the same time, you also want your people to have a career path. You actually think that's a thing?
I think it really depends on the organization. There are organizations, Pivotal's one of them. I mentioned Etsy earlier. Netflix has been pretty good about this lately. There are organizations that tell their employees, go out there and talk about what you're building. Hey, let's open source this stuff. Let's put this stuff out in public. Let's write blog posts, give a conference talk. I think when an organization has that attitude, then their employees feel confident that even if maybe in one individual case, they don't get to have the one piece of tech that they asked for, they are going to be able to work on reasonably new stuff in the public sphere where they can feel confident that everything that they build won't just be ash and dust when they walk away from it and do something new, like that they've actually built something, whether it's platform components or whether it's open source software or whatever. If an organization values you being able to work on stuff that doesn't only apply to them, that also means that they value your career.
Well, okay, so there's another question here about what makes sense for me to be building, because there's a lot of stuff out there. Again, I'll fall back to the networking world for just a minute. Man, people have built the same thing like 8 times. Guys, stop it with the different switches that all do the same thing and so on and so on. Driving me crazy just trying to keep up with this stuff. you know, how do you decide that it makes sense to build something versus using software that's already out there that maybe does what you need?
Well, I mean, maybe I suppose, first of all, on the networking side, if we just need software to find everything, right? Software to find magic will solve everything. From the buy versus build, where buy means get off GitHub or whatever, I think a lot of it might come down to what are your actual goals for what you're trying to accomplish with a specific project. Yelp, for example, open sourced a PaaS that they built with Mesos and Marathon and a number of other things. They called it PaaSTA, which I thought was adorable. It's like, of course Yelp has a PaaS called PaaSTA.
Of course they do, exactly.
Not everyone needs to say, well, that's pretty cool. I'm going to go build a PaaS and base it on Mesos and Marathon. Like, really? Because if the problems you're trying to solve inside your organization would be well solved by such a thing, perhaps you should at least go look at Yelp's GitHub repo and start from there. So it's not that you have to use only off-the-shelf things, because I think it was actually Matt Rainey at Uber who said, like, sometimes you go for off-the-shelf and, like, the shelf is empty. You know, and Katie McCaffrey from Twitter likes to say, like, you know, the stuff that they build because they have to, because like no one else has already built it. But we're not all Twitter. We're not all Uber. And so like for most of our problems, there's probably some open source software that's a good place to start. And that's where I would encourage people, like for creating really novel solutions, like it's really important to look at what's actually valuable to your organization. Because if this is just a game and it's just fun, like maybe that's a good weekend or side project. And something that's really valuable to your organization is probably where it's responsible to spend most of your employer's time that they paid for.
So it seems like the real tension then, I mean, we've kind of highlighted a little bit, but it's around how do I build the new shiny versus leveraging a platform? And in my mind, I don't know, as an ops person that always had a bajillion things to do, I was always looking for a way to abstract away the mind-numbing, boring stuff whenever possible. And it feels like a lot of the infrastructure is now the mind-numbing, boring stuff. I really don't want to deal with reinventing the wheel on that. And reinventing the platform feels like yet another version of that, that it seems like it would be way easier to leverage a platform versus why would I even want to build one, I think is the question here.
Well, I mean, other than resume-driven development, which is, of course, a thing.
Course, yeah.
I think that sometimes people think their problems are more novel and unique than they actually are. And again, because I work at a vendor, I get to go in and talk to a lot of customers. When they're trying to decide if going with, say, for example, our commercially supported platform is right for them, a lot of times this brings us back to the human element. What this actually reveals is the conflict inside an organization. Like there was one meeting that was actually two meetings. And when I realized that we first had a meeting with the head of application development, and then later we had another meeting like 40 miles away with the head of IT infrastructure because they didn't want to be in the same building, I was like, perhaps you shouldn't buy anything from us right now. Like you have deeper problems
Wow.
that software is not going to solve. Definitely spend all the money, but before you think that buying something will solve this, like you need to get people inside your organization on board, because otherwise one of you is going to stand this platform up and like you can't feel the dreams your way to your organization's future. Like just because you install it does not mean they're going to start using it, right?
It goes back to the YOLO versus nope, right?
Right?
There's a 40-mile air gap and lack of even wanting to be in the same room. There's no tech that's going to fix that, except for Nerf guns, I think, might solve that problem.
So I guess that's kind of my entire premise is like software is necessary, definitely, in order to advance in the modern world. It's not sufficient because you also need to make the cultural changes inside your organization to be willing to work with the other group. And especially if you have a lot of legitimate, justified, deep-seated resentments of them, possibly because they've led to you getting paged in the middle of the night quite a lot. And so they want some shiny new thing and you're kind of mistrustful of it. This is where having the humility and the patience to talk with them and find out why they want the things they want is really, really valuable. And I think that's one of the reasons that at the company where I work, we also do IT transformation consulting work with people who are on this journey, just because we can give them great software, but that's not going to solve every problem they have.
Sure. It's like technical counseling.
Yeah. Technical counseling. I love it. Oh, talking with other humans. It's the hard thing. It's so much easier to sit there as an ops person, get the inbound ticket for provisioning and just do that and not ask any questions and keep your head down and march on, as opposed to looking at it going, I know this does not make sense, and then trying to find the right person or people to talk to and hash out and go, okay, you asked me for this. What you really want is this based on this conversation.
that's easier in the short run, but then when you're dealing with the botched deployment, you're kicking yourself wishing I said something 6 months ago. I should have.
Exactly. Well, Bridget, thank you very much for taking the time to chat with us on DataKnots today. How can people follow you on the internet?
They can find me on the Twitters at Bridget Krumhout or BridgetKrumhout.com. I have links to probably dozens, if not hundreds of hours of conference talks of me running my mouth about exactly this. A number of recent conference talks, a short one, it was like 9 minutes, a keynote at SpringOne Platform at the Pivotal Conference this year. So they can watch the short version of me talking about similar topics with some slides.
Awesome. And I have been following you, and the pink hair thing is for real.
Oh, and they can, depending on when this goes live, they can also come to Velocity New York next week. We'll be a number of us, me, Charity Majors from Honeycomb, Tim Gross from Joyant, and John Vincent from, I believe he's at MailChimp now, are going to be talking about ops in the time of serverless containerized web scale.
Ooh, so this is going to be the week of September 19th?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, depending on when this show goes out, that might have already been passed. Do you happen to know if Velocity is going to put those talks online?
Absolutely. They will be able to watch that.
You'll be able to find that on YouTube. I'm starting to find all kinds of content on YouTube. In fact, if all I did was watch content, I would do nothing else and still not have caught up to all the I'm trying to plow through serverless conf right now.
Oh, I'm trying not to be snarky right now because I know that's actually all you do, but...
Hey.
So what you want is you want YouTube-DL. It's just an open source. I think it's like a Python or Go binary or something. I forget. But YouTube-DL lets you grab videos off YouTube very, very easily from your command line and have them on your laptop for during flights.
Ooh, that's not a bad idea. And that is going to be it, however, for today's edition of the DataKnots podcast. You can reach me at EC Banks on Twitter. My blog is ethancbanks.com. And you can digitally probe Chris at Chris Wall on Twitter and his blog, wallnetwork.com. For more of our DataKnots shows about infrastructure engineering, park your jet black spaceship with the black buttons and the black lights at Milliways. And from the end of the universe, stare deeply into the eyes of packetpushers.net. Held in that welcoming gaze, you'll find the DataKnots talking about containers and conferences, certifications, PowerShell, moving to cloud, full stack engineering, whatever that is, storage architecture, and so much more. And until then, may your server lights blink, your storage spindles spin, and your cables be cleanly managed. That in the background, there's like massive machines doing things outside my window.
Why do you put something about probing me in every episode, man?
I don't know, it was there.
Always a probe.